I think it's particularly important when we consider this temptation to despondency, to gloominess, to be clear what we mean by it in light of modern psychology. And for that reason, I've included an article by Dr. Jane Gehrs. It's actually two of a series of four articles which Dr. Gehrs wrote on the subject of emotions and spirituality. These are the articles on joy and shame, and we will later take a look at the articles on anger and forgiveness, as they're appropriate when we consider the relevant tempting thoughts. Dr. Gehrs has the advantage, from our perspective, of being both a clinical psychologist, a very fine psychotherapist, and an excellent scientist as well. She was in charge of the forensic psychology program at Patton State Hospital, which is one of the hospitals for the criminally insane in Southern California, for some time. And she was she's also a Benedictine oblate and a very deeply spiritual person, and is widely read in the spiritual tradition. So she brings together an appreciation of what psychology has to offer in terms of insight into feelings and some insight into the cure of the feelings, but she also has a very deep conviction that the monastic tradition was there before and has much to offer which psychology has yet to properly appropriate. So I've included the articles on joy and shame for the reason that spiritual authors very often describe the antidote or the opposite of the kind of sorrow or despondency, which is the subject of our study here, the tempting thought of gloominess. The opposite of it is spiritual joy. Now, we must always bear in mind that the authors emphasize that there is this proper and good use of holy sorrow, but there is also a joy which is linked to the idea, paradoxically linked to the idea of holy sorrow. And so as to appreciate this relationship better and get a sense of what we mean by joy, I've included both her articles on joy and shame. I won't attempt to read out sections of it, but just to point out how they're structured and invite you to read them on your own. She speaks in the article on joy, first of all, on the role of emotion in relationships. And in particular, when she speaks of joy in the second section of this first essay, I'm particularly fond of her pointing out this insight that there is an intimate relationship that begins very shortly after birth, when the infant first gazes or begins to gaze into the eyes of the mother. And there is a kind of a mutual gazing that promotes relationship. This is an archetypal and not just symbolic, but very real human experience and an essential one. And if one is deprived of it, it can have very serious consequences later in life. But of course, it is also a paradigm of divine union, the mutual gazing, the gazing into the face of the one who gazes back with love. That is that which evokes the response of human joy. She also quotes, I think very appropriately, from C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters in a way that tries to distinguish between false joy or cheap happiness on the one hand and a deep, profound joy on the other. And there are several quotes from the Psalms that in particular emphasize this. She speaks about the value and importance of laughter, but also distinguishes between, as does C.S. Lewis in particular, flippancy or cynical mirth, malicious sarcasm, hostile teasing, and laughter. This is one of the reasons why in Benedict's Rule there are stringent prohibitions against the kind of laughter which in Benedict's day was a very negative and destructive kind of cynical negativity that is best experienced or seen in the ancient comedies, which we would hopefully not find funny at all, but are very often very devastating and destructive critiques of another. There was a laughing at in a way that devalued the other that has nothing to do with true laughter and true joy. She talks also about grasping as her concluding point in the article on joy, and again I'll leave you to look at that to discover her insights into the notion of the kind of freedom and non-attachment that is essential for the experience of human joy. Her second article which in some ways is even more central to our study, is the question of shame, of which we've already seen one of the root biblical terms. The problem, as she highlights, is the fact that although there is a holy use of sorrow or penthos or mourning, as we'll see in even more detail when we look just a bit at those terms and at the Eastern tradition exemplified by Saint Simeon, there's a terrible mistake, a perversion of sorrow that can occur when one has a sense that it is not the act of which one should be ashamed, but the self itself. When one directs this powerful, if you will, negative response that is appropriate to direct against sin, when directed against, when it's directed instead against the sinner or against the self, it will result in this experience of shame and, as Dr. Garris describes it, a kind of emotional paralysis. She talks about the fact that one should distinguish between shame and guilt, or at least begin to do that, although the ability to do this is still in its infancy as far as the psychological community is concerned. She also talks about, just as she had this sense of a primordial human experience that evokes joy, she tries to do an analogous kind of thing in terms of shame, something that occurs in childhood, but which, if it's a process towards understanding behavior that needs to change, and if it's constantly surrounded by the reassurance of love, so that one doesn't get the sense of unlovableness as a result of being ashamed of something, it doesn't have a destructive effect. But if one mistakes the idea of being shamed or ashamed with "I am shameful at best," or at base, at the deepest level, then there's a profound destruction of the self-image and an incapacity to engage in wholesome or life-giving relationships. She talks, as the article goes on, about implications of this for relationships with others and relationships with God, and then talks about some of the modern literature on the healing of shame and several authors whose work is fairly accessible, and then talks about her own conviction that there is a profoundly religious, a profoundly spiritual basis for the healing of shame, because, to put it in other terms than she uses, there is an ontological problem that's been created, or at least something very close to it. The person has mistaken their nature, what they are at base, their own being, for the problematic consequences of wrong choices. One has identified wrongness not with the action, but with the essence of the self. And that can be the source of all kinds of destructive conclusions and even behaviors. And of course, theologically, it's absolutely wrong, and it is indeed a heresy. Human nature is not evil. Human nature is fallen. We have a tendency towards choosing the wrong things, but that does not mean that our nature itself has become ontologically evil. We may do shameful things, but we are not naturally shameful. That is not the nature of the human person. And as I said, we will look at two more articles carrying some of Dr. Garris's insights a little further in subsequent sections of the course.